This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where once again it is my great pleasure to feature as my guest an internationally recognized expert on assassins and assassinations, Ole Damegaard. And today we're going to talk about Ole's research on JFK especially. But Ole, I understand that since we have done some of these interviews about Haley Otis and the Toronto crime family, that your websites seem to be subjected to some form of filtering. Is that right?
Yeah, I have absolutely no idea how it's working. I just know that since I've got the stat counter on my website, and since the 1st of March, I've had 12,000 hits on my website, which is a lot. And during the first few days of March, I had a lot of inquiries, book orders, comments, all of this thing. It was just rolling. And then, boom, it came to a full stop, sort of. And I can receive emails when I ask people to send me emails. I get them. But otherwise than that, it's just zero, zero, zero. So whatever is going on, I do not know.
Well, that's suggests to me as an indirect confirmation that what we're reporting is true and that Haley is basically right, even though you and I both agree that sometimes she draws conclusions that we think are mistaken. It seems to me that her knowledge is so detailed, so specific, so broad, so comprehensive, and in so many respects fits with what you and I both know from our own previous investigations on assassinations, that it seems to me there's a core of credibility there that is extremely difficult to deny.
I totally agree with that.
Ole, where shall we begin? I do have a short clip with Haley in relation to JFK that I thought we might feature during the second segment, but I want to begin by giving you the opportunity to lay out your views about the assassination of John F. Kennedy, which will be the principal subject of our conversation today.
I think let's do it the other way around. First, Haley, and then I'll go into this because it's really details and it's very difficult to chop it up in pieces.
Oh, okay. You want me to go ahead and play the clip from Haley?
Yes, please.
Okay. Here it comes.
The move out and us go to Australia, you know, because I probably would have had a different life there. I hovered, and my mother hovered in her room. We put all these padlocks on the door to keep Clyde and Walter Tobinski out. Walter Tobinski, in a book called Appointment in Dallas, said that he's a mercenary. Well, for God's sake, he's saying, you know, who he is. He's killed thousands. A mercenary is a paid, hired killer. God knows how many that
So you think Walter has killed as many as Clyde?
No, Walter's killed more than Clyde.
Really?
He's the one that they send. If you read that book again, they sent him into Guatemala, Nicaragua, you know, Central America during the Iran-Contra affair, right? He went in there to kill women, children. God knows how many people he killed in there. Then he says in his statement to Hugh McDonald, when he wrote, you know, the confession, that he was disillusioned with the whole killing scenario. The CIA made him do Operation Chaos. So they went in. It's a depopulation. They don't want these people in from Central America into Canada, United States. We can't deal with all these people. So they go in there as a depopulation agenda. That's why I said that probably that tsunami that hit the Philippines was purposely done because there's so many people on a yearly basis proliferating, and they can't handle that through the, you know, immigration laws. We can't even handle what we've got here now in Canada, because they all get on the system. The welfare system here in Canada is better than the United States, in Ontario especially, because you can get all kinds of perks, you know, your medical and your dentistry and everything. So they are all on it. Anyway, when I called this Brian Borg, this fellow, he started saying, look, I've gone back, I said, to 1945, and I said, you haven't even put a lot of the cases there. This one is very important, this woman's name of Agnes Oregon. Her throat was slit. That was another one that I was scared you know, to bits of, because I was thrown on a woman by the name of Elizabeth Henrietta Kirby Boyington. This is 1959. Remember I told you that Clyde had killed this Patricia Lubkin, then he killed this Ida Dean Jean, then he blew off this guy's head, half of his head, with a shotgun, Rael Tesler. I'll spell you the name and I'll send it tomorrow. That was on Thursday, March the 31st, 1959, is when he took off this guy's head with the shotgun. This was just prelude to him taking off the head of Kennedy. He already learned how to take someone's head off with a, you know, a shotgun, shot off shotgun.
Did Clyde claim he had hit JFK?
Yeah. In the head. Like I said, he already planned that, I told you, that weekend. Right after he had done this lumber yard, he set an explosive. He used all the time with Tobinski. He learned to get into safes and that. They used I just got home. I am not even thinking straight here. They used this explosive, a little bit of, it's in a bottle. What do you call that stuff?
Nitroglycerin.
So he left a bottle of nitroglycerin that he just used in this Oakland lumber yard. He blew the thing apart. There was a lot of people that were, you know, maimed because of that. And then he had this gun, left that in the phone booth. I was just in that mall where it was at Eglinton and Bayview, and I saw him place something there, and then next thing I know, he's right where I'm living in the bushes, comes up behind me, puts this gun to the back of my head. He says, "The cops are after me. Let me get into the house before I shoot your brains out." So he pushes me in the house, starts telling he's wired as hell, and then he says the orders came that Kennedy's got to go. And on the Friday before that happened, September of 63, Kennedy had gone before the UN and spoke up about Israel having these nuclear, secretive plant in the Negev Desert. And he had written this letter, which he repeated, and the orders came from Israel that the guy's got to go. Clyde used to talk all the time that the head mafia was Meyer Lansky. It's all to do with the Israelis that ordered the hit. It comes to the Rothschild, back to the whole, scenario. Who's the head mob? Who's the top mob? It all comes to the banksters, the Rothschilds. So that's the weekend where I knew that Kennedy was going to go, that they had already talked. He had talked about that open limo scene. They had planned this thing. I couldn't believe it, you know. Anyway, so everything turned exactly, that what he had said true to fact.
Where did you find the picture of Clyde and Rayol in
It was when the shots were taken of the Black Dog Man. What's so important is one of the guys that phoned in, or that you interviewed, you don't know if Sabuter ever shot the film. Well, one guy, an Italian, who, let me try to get his name here, who took it from the other side, has a woman standing on that on that pedestal area where Sabuter said he was. You don't ever have Sabuter's full face. Even Ike Alchin's photograph is from some guy with a fedora hat on. Now, I started analyzing all the photos that, what's his name, Robin Unger?
Unger
has posted over and over. Not only was the guy on the stairwell, that's Dieter Sims. Remember I showed you, or I sent you that picture of the for Balaclava Bill, where you know, composite of it was my brother, then Peter, then Clyde, and then James Earl Ray.
You know, I think you've sent me things that I never got. I don't think I ever got
okay,
that.
I'll do it again. Now, what I'm going to do is I sent...
Ole, I think, that, you know, that's a very interesting, although I'm convinced that Haley has a couple of points wrong. I mean, obviously, JFK didn't have his head shot off with a shotgun. And, you know, I've had a difficulty discerning what shot she believes that Clyde actually fired, because JFK, based upon my research, was hit four different times in the back, about 5.5 inches below the collar, just to the right of the spinal column, a shot fired from the top of the county records building, and the throat by a shot fired from the south end of the triple underpass that passed through the windshield. Then, after the limousine was brought to a halt, twice in the head, once from behind by a shot fired from the Dowell Tax, where he slumped forward. Then Jack eased him back up, and he was hit in the right temple by a shot fired from the right front, namely the north end of the triple underpass, where that shooter appears to have been Frank Sturgis, not Clyde Forshaw. So that part is, to me, a bit problematic. And, of course, the whole issue about, you know, Zapruder did not film the Zapruder film, because the Zapruder film is a fabrication put together in a laboratory, and no one shot a film that was put together in a laboratory, regardless of whether in some instances he appears, looks somewhat like a woman. I mean, he alleged to have been up there with Marilyn Seitzman, who was his secretary, who was helping him retain his balance because he suffered from vertigo. So we can set that issue about Zapruder aside for today at least. And I'm a little puzzled about what shot she believes that Clyde may have fired. I'm therefore very interested in your take on all of this, Ollie.
I think with Haley, for me, it's like it's only after listening to so many hours. I think I listened to at least 100 hours of your conversations. And it's when you hear it, all of it, that's when you really start grasping the gravity of her testimony, the evidence that she's putting forward, not her conclusions, just like you say. But she, like most of us, are trying to put together this incredible jigsaw that is made to be impossible to get together. I mean, that's made by this design. The whole conspiracy is built like that, so that it's very, very complicated to sort out the pieces. So I would say, for people who doubt her, don't listen to just a little here, a little there, a little, and so on. You need to listen to a lot, and then the importance of her testimony will come forward. This is also why I, for one, is going to try and get as much out publicly as possible.
I recommend people go back to the original article, Bank Robbers and Serial Killers, which I published on Veterans Today on, I think it was the 21st of December, 2012, and listen to all those audios, don't you think, Ole? I mean, I think there may be a couple of hours with her altogether there.
Yeah, it's a great start, for sure. That was how I got started, and to start with, I thought, my God, this woman, she's mad, or what is she on about? But then the longer I listened, the more I just felt that she's putting forward so many of these crucial pieces that have been missing for all of these centuries, decades.
That's right. And just take the identification of the man photographed in Mexico City as Walter Tobinski. Can you tell me the combined resources of the CIA, the FBI, the federal government has never been able to identify that person? I mean, it's ridiculous. It's completely ridiculous. I mean, Grodin, in his book, The Search for Lee Harvey Oswald, has, you know, 6 or 8 or more photographs of this man. And if that identification alone is accurate, I mean, what Haley has given us is of enormous importance.
And this is also, I mean, she puts forward evidence and details about, I don't know, countless amount of murders. I mean, if a normal person would approach the police and know something about one murder or two murders, that would be a scandal if the police didn't do anything. But here we're talking about, like, I don't know how many, 50, 60, 100, 1,000. I mean, the numbers are just staggering, and still no one is doing anything, which I think is very telling.
I think so, too. It's like when I called the Toronto Police and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and even the FBI, because a lot of these bank robberies have occurred in the United States. and no one would raise their least digit. And when I even went to the U.S. attorney right here in Madison, I mean, Oli, it's appalling, absolutely appalling, and tends to reinforce the observation of Jim Mars that they are protected.
This is the thing. That's the only conclusion you can get. And I just want to say that when I was deeply involved in the investigation of the murder of the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, two of my friends were doing exactly what she was doing, you know, but they had no feeling for, they kept pushing towards the official sources, you know, they kept approaching the official investigation, they kept pushing the normal police to release more and more evidence and take their testimonies, because they were refused as well. They were not, one of them were trying to press charges against two Swedish policemen that were involved in the assassinations. Their names are Thomas Pitz and Leif Tell. And the police refused to take, to accept the paper that he had filled in, the form where he accused these policemen. It was neglected. And afterwards he died, and my other friend, one died of cancer that came after he had a health check. He was fine. He came out, boom, within days. He had severe brain cancer, and he died shortly afterwards. And the other guy was found with his head bashed in the subway, saying that it was an accident, that he had fallen in the stairs. But then when we tried to get the autopsy report out from the pathology, it took 8 months of pressure from policemen that was involved as well in the group I was taking part of, was pushing to get these documents out, and it took 8 months.
That's appalling.
No, it's telling. It's very telling. It's just the same thing we're up against, that the people in so-called power are covering it up. They do everything to stop important information to get out there. And this is why, if, I mean, Haley can keep on and on and on and try to go the official way, which would be the normal and real, the only possible way to go through the police to investigate these things. But I feel very sure that she will just knock her head bloody against a wall, a brick wall. It needs to come out in another way. And that's why you and I take a step forward, put ourselves on the line to get the info out there, because people need to know what's going on, because she's not the only one who are being met like this. I mean, many other people, I'm sure, have lots of important information and are being met the same way, by threats or disregard, or they make jokes of you or call you crazy or whatever, instead of treating you like a very important witness.
You would think the citizens of Toronto would care if a conductor of a trolley or bus in Toronto actually was a serial killer and had wiped out many of his own passengers, not to mention hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of other residents of Toronto, with the police knowing full well who had committed these crimes and doing nothing about it.
It's an absolute scandal, and it's very telling, I would say, in a very scary way. It's scary. Really is.
Well, shall we turn to JFK, Ole? I know that, you know, we both agree that Haley is providing some crucial pieces, I think, not only about JFK, but potentially also about Martin Luther King, about Bobby, and even about John, where it appears that Clyde, with one of his son Jay, who is an instructor pilot instructor at Buttonville Airport, loaded his plane with high explosive while he was there, having been lured up by Frank Stronach with promises of financial support for George Magazine reinvestigating the death of his father. That's the best I can do in piecing it together.
I can only say that when really looking into, for three decades, the assassination of JFK, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and many, many other assassinations, I've found that there's a very, very crucial team of assassins that have been used since the late 1950s all the way up until more or less today. Now, most of them are dead by now, but there's still some of them active. And two of them seem to be Clyde Forshaw and Walter Tobinski, very closely, not part of this group called Operation 40, or at least I've never encountered their names, but they seem to be working very, very closely together with them. And so everything that that Haley puts forward just fits in together with the pieces of puzzles that I've been able to suss out.
Yeah, it's really astounding that there should be a core group of assassins committing so many murders. I mean, in all kinds of crimes. I mean, bank robberies, knocking off ATMs, savage murders, arsons. I mean, the list is virtually endless. At one point, Clyde says, "I am the mob," and Haley has to agree.
One of the things that with some of the people involved in this is that they're really proud of what they're doing. You know, they brag. Some of them brag when they get drunk. There are other ones that are very, very disciplined, highly skilled, quiet people that are very efficient. But people like Clyde seem to be very proud of it and almost boasting about, bragging about these things.
Opperman, broadcast, that's 3-hour special, which is accessible online at the Opperman Report. I mean, he said that we were naming two of the greatest serial killers in history, namely Clyde Forshaw and Walter Tobinski, and I dare say, Ole, that appears to be the case.
Well, I never heard of anything like it, not even close.
I agree, it's completely unprecedented. I mean, and it's
according
just...
to what. No, according to what Haley claims that Clyde has told her, he personally is responsible for at least 1,000 people. And she says that Walter has killed even more because he's the sinister one.
Well, a lot of Walter's murders appear to have been ones that took place in Guatemala, for example, in Latin America, yeah. Where he was sent and he was slaughtering whole villages of men, women, and children. So I think that's where his numbers accumulated. I think that most of Clyde's hits appear to have been, you know, mob or crime related, apart from the, you know, the vicious killings of women who were, you know, in isolated places. And but I mean, it's almost an endless list.
Yeah, but like I said, with this Operation 40, they were sent. They were used first in the Bay of Pigs invasion. They were used to try and take out Fidel Castro, which they failed with. Then they were in Dealey Plaza. Many of the players there came from Operation 40. I can go into great details for that. But then after that, they were used. They were sent to Chile in 1973 when they took out Salvador Allende. After that, they were part of Operation Condor, where they, for one of the things, they were used as trainers, like for torture, for killing, for slaughtering people, from all of these things. They were used there to train local police officers and military to do torture and these things. But also they were used in what was called Operation Condor, where they went globally almost to track down Allende supporters. They were part of blowing up Orlando Letier in Washington, D.C. at Embassy Row, where they put a car bomb in that. And then they were part of a whole anti-Cuban movement where they blew up airplanes, they blew up embassies, they blew up shops. And I mean, they killed loads and loads of people doing that. Then these members were pardoned. Oliver Bosch was one. Luis Posada Carillas was another one, pardoned by George Bush Sr., of all people, go figure, because George Bush Sr. was also the paymaster for Operation 40. And what many people are not aware of, that this Operation 40 was created by the order of President Dwight Eisenhower in the late 1950s. And the guy he put in charge of getting this hit team together that could be used globally was his vice president, Richard Nixon.
Ole, let's take a break here, and then we can return to your analysis of the assassination of JFK. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest today, a return engagement with Ole Damigard. We'll be right back.
Is there anybody going to listen to my story, all about the girl who came to stay? She's the kind of girl you want so much it makes you sorry. Still, you don't regret a single day. Ah, girl. Girl, girl. will turn to me and start to cry. And she promises the earth to me, and I believe her. After all this time, I don't know why. Oh, girl. Girl who put you down when friends are there, you feel a fool. When you say she's looking good, she acts as if it's understood she's cool. Ooh, 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 girl. Girl, girl. Was she told when she was young?
Even Bush admits that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. Our own FBI acknowledged it has no hard evidence that ties Osama bin Laden to 9/11. But if Saddam had nothing to do with 9/11, and if Osama had nothing to do with 9/11, then who did it?
Who did it?
The 9/11 conspiracy provides the answer. Discover the big picture. Learn what we know now. Find out what it means. 11 experts contribute to exposing the truth as the anatomy of an atrocity. Edited by James H. Fetzer. Buy it now if you have the courage to face the truth. Just don't think you're going to like it. The 9/11 conspiracy provides the answer.
Michelle, my belle, someday more keep on play. say the only words I know that you'll understand, ma Michelle.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing my conversation with Ole Domegaard. Ole, I want you to give us your take in great detail about what happened to JFK, the whole story.
Okay, I believe that I might have been able to find out other pieces of puzzles that have been missing. And I know we don't agree on all details, but one thing that I love with our conversation is that both you and I are very open to new ideas. And the main thing is that the puzzle gets laid. Whoever it makes, it puts in the right pieces, is not of importance. So if it's okay with you, I would like to go into some details and do some speculation as well.
Sure, please. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, Ole. Go for it.
Okay, so one of the ways that I've approached this from a new direction is to look at the different vehicles that were used in the assassination, and through the vehicles, backtrack and see how and who were there and how the whole thing was done. And there's some whistleblowers that have come forward. There's Tosh Plumlee, who was a pilot who was part of this Operation 40 earlier on. Who claims that he was in Dealey Plaza that day, but that he was part of an operation to abort the assassination. There's another whistleblower by the name of Chauncey Holt, who was a CIA operative and a forger, who also came forward with a lot of interesting details. And there's a man who's still alive. His name is James Files, who claims to be the shooter behind the picket fence.
And of course, as you know, I've done a lot with Chauncey Holt, including meeting him in person, and have a lot to say about him. And you and I have differing views about James Files, but I agree with you completely that we want to see what we can do to make sure all the pieces fit the right way.
Exactly. And this is why I think it's so important to, once you start checking out how these different testimonies fit together, if they fit together. I mean, because there's a lot of lies going around and disinformation and so on. This is why I've tried to put pieces together that I don't think has been put forward before. So I would like to go through some of the vehicles.
Yeah.
Like behind the picket fence, there was a watchtower for the train station, and a man was there called Lee Bowers. Now he saw the sort of behind the picket fence, he saw some people there, and he saw that things were going on. But before the assassination itself, he saw three different vehicles come in to the parking lot, circle around some of them, and then go out again. So one of these vehicles was a 1959 Oldsmobile that looked like it had been a bit dirty, and there was one guy driving around in it in the parking lot and then leaving again. I think it was seen about 20 minutes before the assassination itself. Okay, this 1959 Oldsmobile, I would suggest, was owned by a man called Peter Licavoli. He was a mob figure that had a place in Arizona, a ranch there, a beautiful place with a pool and landing strip and so on, a perfect place for the mob and other people involved that for meeting when it came to different operations. Now, Charles Nicoletti was one of Sam Giancana's henchmen, a hitman that was very disciplined. He was one of these guys I spoke to you about before, never drank, very quiet, very efficient, very reliable, and so on. His name was Charles Chucky Nicoletti, and he was ordered to go to the Grace Ranch in Arizona and meet up with Chauncey Holt. Now, Chauncey Holt was this CIA operative who also worked for the mob for decades, in and out. I mean, most of these people, they worked both for the agency but also for the mob and for the FBI sometimes. I mean, they were in and out. Sometimes it's very hard to tell the difference, what is what. And Chauncey Holt was a very interesting person, I think, also very brave. He was an assassin, a CIA operative, an artist, a forger. And because his artistic, he was also a circus acrobat. But because of his skills with arts, he was very, very good at forging fake documents and IDs and so on. And he was working in a place in Los Angeles where on the fifth floor was the sort of called, the, like a factory, not real factory, but the department where they made the real stars and identifications for the different troopers and Secret Service and so on around the country. And on the sixth floor in the same building, the CIA had this secret office, and this is where Chauncey was working. So he got real IDs, Secret Service IDs and so on from the department downstairs. And some of this, he had was given an order to bring fake Secret Service IDs to Dallas this day. And the idea was that he should bring them in a bag, and he should deliver them to either of two people, one guy called Homer Echevarria or a man by the name of Charles Harrelson. Charles Harrelson was one an assassin from Louisiana, one of the mobster Carlos Marcelo's hitmen, and also the father of the author Woody Harrelson.
Just to introduce a couple of caveats here, he was also, of course, a very proficient marksman and ran a school for assassins. At one point, he was the accountant for Meyer Lansky, which, of course, is the most sensitive position in the mob. He was working at the Los Angeles Stamp and Stationery store at the time this happened, and it was instructed by his handler, Philip Twombly, to prepare 15 sets of forged Secret Service credentials for use in and around Dealey Plaza. He was worried that he might not get the color-coded pins for that the Secret Service agents use that change from time to time, but that he did get that information. He was instructed to leave them in a red pickup truck that was parked in the lot behind the grassy knoll, which was used by the Dallas police. When he first got there, the truck wasn't there, and he wandered around Dealey Plaza and told me that he saw more hitmen, mercenaries, and assassins than you'd find at a Soldiers of Fortune convention. He then returned to the pickup truck, the area where it was to be, and was there and left them. He had been instructed to meet with Charles Harrelson and with a man he knew as Richard Montoya, who actually turns out to be Charles Rogers, and that they were to proceed down to a railway car in behind the picket, the parking lot area when the shooting took place. Go ahead, Ole.
Yeah, I would say spot on. Thank you so much, Jim. The only thing that I would say differs is that the pickup was green, as far as I know.
No, he told me it was red, but you go ahead.
No, because anyway, let's go back. So Chauncey Holt was to meet and deliver these fake IDs that were used right after the shooting. There were lots of people running up the grassy knoll that were met by Secret Service people with Secret Service IDs, and officially the Secret Service was not there that day. So you have that's what he was supposed to do. Nicoletti was there to be part of the hit team, and there was another man from the mob, Leo Moseri. He was there. Now we're talking at the Grace Ranch now in Arizona, and also a pilot called by the name of John Canty, who worked for the CIA from time to time. Now they were supposed to fly in a Cessna from this ranch to Dallas, but due to the luggage, it was so heavy that the things that they were carrying, they had to take a car instead. So Peter Licavoli, he offered them this 1959 Oldsmobile. I think it was light blue. Anyway, so they took that one, and they were supposed to be in Dallas on the night of the 21st of November, where they were supposed to go to the Cabana Motor Hotel. The Cabana Motor Hotel at that time was owned by Doris Day, and it was one place. There were several meetings the night before the assassination, and it seems like one of the meetings were in the Cabana Motor Hotel, where Jack Ruby was part of this meeting, among others. Anyway, on the way towards Dallas, they had motor problems first, engine problems, so they had to stop and get that fixed. And then they went through one of the worst thunderstorms in ages. So they even had to stop because the weather was so, so bad. And I think this is one of the reasons why the car observed in the parking lot was very dirty because of this weather. Anyway, so these were that car with these four people coming there. So I would suggest that most probably the driver, when it was driving around in the parking lot, would be Leo Morseri or Paul Canty, the pilot, who I think he was later part of flying out parts of the team out of Dallas. Anyway, and the pickup truck, as far as I have found out from John C. Holt, it was green, and I might be wrong there if it was not green, because there was a witness by the name of Julian Mercer who observed just about 40 minutes before the assassination. She saw a green pickup truck that was parked up on the pavement just near the grassy knoll, and she identified the driver as being Jack Ruby. And she saw somebody take off guns from the back of the truck and started walking up towards the Texas School Book Depository in that direction. Anyway, so
my impression was that he had a gun case and she saw him walking up toward the picket fence, on the grassy knoll. But you know,
exactly, we're more or less picket fence.
But she did identify subsequently that the driver was Jack Ruby.
Yeah, and so. What I thought, my conclusion would be that there was a possibility for that green truck to be the same green truck on the parking lot. But if it was red, then apparently it was different vehicles. Anyway, you have another vehicle that was observed by Lee Bowers. And that was, it was observed about 12:20 in the parking lot. It was driving around there. And it was a black Ford Falcon, most probably from 57. Now, according to Chauncey Holt, the driver was speaking in a microphone. And according to Chauncey Holt, that man was an assassin, highly skilled assassin by the name of Aldo Vera Serafin, who was he was very bold and reckless and not very trustworthy. There was a lot of people that had problems with him. But at the same time, he was looked upon as being one of the top assassins at that time. He was driving around there speaking in a microphone. And if you look at the Dealey Plaza from above, you will see that there are different team of shooters. There's also radio operators with walkie-talkies in their back pockets. Like you got the guy in front of the umbrella man waving. I think his name was Felipe Vidal Santiago. I'm going to come back to him. He had a walkie-talkie in the back pocket. There was also another man that has admitted that he was part of the whole thing. His name was Jim Hicks. And I think, I have a theory that at least when you look at these assassinations, very, very often there's like a communication center very close by a highly technical equipped either a hotel suite or a factory building, a fire station or something like that. Like in 9/11, where I think most probably the whole thing was orchestrated from Building 7. And I think in when it came to Dallas, I think that the place that they used was the Adolphus Hotel, which is just a few hundred meters from Dealey Plaza down Commerce Street. And according to some sources, even Sam Giancana was here that day, and he had rented a room there together with one of his hitmen, a man by the name of Richard Kane. I'm going to come back to them later. Okay, so we have... Also, there were two cars coming from Miami. This is the one, if people have seen the JFK movie, that's the one in the beginning where they throw out a woman there, a prostitute, by the name of Rosie Sheremy. And she was the one who was on some kind of a drug, but really trying to warn that there was going to be a hit going down in Dallas a few days later. In that car, as far as I've been able to find out, it was Marita Lawrence, part of Operation 40. Gary Hemming, who was also closely connected to Operation 40, I think he was part of Interpen as well, which was a very closely entangled web of assassins and soldier fortunes and so on. Orlando Bosch, which was the mastermind behind hundreds of terror acts over the years afterward. Frank Sturgis, and Pedro Diaz-Lanz, and also the Novo brothers, the Ignacio and what's the other guy's name? Novo San Paul. Ignacio y Lawrence, I can't remember. But these two cars were coming from Miami, also with loads of guns, going to a safe house in Dallas, preparing for this whole assassination. And you will see that they're different vehicles are coming from different directions with weapons, with assassins, and so on. I would also suggest, based on Haley's testimony, that there will have been one car coming from, most probably from Toronto, and that would be a Plymouth with wooden side, roof rack, turquoise, and white, registered on Haley's father. And in it, my guess is that Clyde Forshaw was there, Walter Tobinski, Haley's brother, Roland Otis, and most probably as well, Charles Frederick Rogers, the guy that you mentioned, he went under the alias Carlos Montoya, which is also the guy...
Richard Montoya, yeah.
Richard, Carlos, I've heard both of them. I don't know which one. I think many of these have multiple identities that they used. So I would very much suggest that that would be one of the cars that they transported the shooters and arms also to Dallas that day. Also, let me see here. Now, if we take James Files, which I've studied in great details, I know that you do not believe in him, but I would say when you study this guy from his early age, and then what happened as well after the assassination, you will see that he is so deeply involved with the same assassins over the years, way, way down until he finally ended up in jail. Like after the shooting of JFK, he was part of the one that delivered the explosives when they blew up Orlando Letier in Washington, D.C. He brought the explosive from the Dominican Republic. He was also the guy who supplied him with the same type of explosives when they blew up a Cuban airliner on Jamaica, I think. Barbados, killing 73 people. He was also part of the overtake of Salvador Allende, where he was present when Salvador Allende was murdered. And he was also part in many, many other operations. He was working together with one... I think his name is Tom Wilson, a former Operation 40 operative who later tried to sell loads and loads of explosives to Gaddafi in Libya. And I think that was in 72. I'm not sure about the year and so on. But what I'm saying is that this guy has continued to work within the same team afterwards. And if you look at his history, his background, he says that he was born, I think, 1942. And he grew up when he was 16 years old. His sister was murdered by her new husband. So he took the law in his own hands and blew the head of this guy. After that, at the age of 16, he went and got drafted to the military. And he went into the 82nd Airborne, which was an elite paratrooper group. That's the one... that the whole Band of Brothers epic story by Spielberg and the rest of the guys, they're telling their story. So he joined there some years later after the Second World War as a 16-year-old. And after training and so on, he was sent to Laos. He was one of the so-called military advisors there. And it turns out that there was some kind of situation that occurred there. I don't know what happened really, but... for some reason, he executed two of his own people with headshots. And after that, he was sent back to the States to an army hospital where he was waiting for evaluation, where he was approached by David Attlee Phillips. And David Attlee Phillips approached him on the recommendation from Ted Shackley. Now, David Attlee Phillips and Ted Shackley are two very, very high CIA operatives that are crucial in the whole JFK assassination. And anyway, so according to files, David Attlee Phillips recruited him to the CIA. He didn't even know what the CIA was by then. But at that time, but he was recruited for his cold-bloodedness and skill to kill and so on. So he was recruited very young. Anyway, so he went back to Chicago. He did some jobs for the CIA. He was part of training exiled Cubans and so preparing for the Bay of Pigs invasion and so on. He was in Louisiana. Training them, and he met Lee Harvey Oswald in Louisiana once. Once again, this green pickup, he says that was the same. Oh, it was an old rusty green pickup that Oswald came driving in, and they exchanged some weapons and then parted again. Anyway, when he went back to Chicago, he used to drive stock cars, and like he claims himself, there are two things that he's really good at. It's shooting and driving. These are the two things for him. And in one of these races, he was observed by Chucky Nicoletti, the hitman that I told you about before, Sam Giancana's right hand when it came to get rid of people. And Nicoletti approached James Files and said, would you like to be my driver? And Files knew about Nicoletti. It was the same neighborhood and so on. And he looked upon him as a god. So he was very honored and he said, yes, yeah, I would love to do that. So he became his partner, but more like errand boy and driver. Also, the longer they worked together, then he got more and more responsibility when it came to fixing the weapons, to taking car and other cars, trimming them and so on, because they used what they called work cars that were bulletproof sides. They had number plates that could rotate. They had gun racks inside the seats and so on. And so he was part of multiple assassinations together with Chucky Nicoletti for the mob side. Whatever they were ordered to do, he carried out. He had no problem with that at all. Anyway, then in the summer of 63, Chucky Nicoletti was called to a meeting where Johnny Rosselli and some other people were there. Johnny Rosselli was a mobster and the liaison between the mob and the CIA and the government. He had lots of connections also in Hollywood and so on. And he was sort of the spider in the whole web. And when Nicoletti came out from the meeting, he said, well, we're going to hit your friend a bit later this year. Do you want to be in it? So Files thought, he thought it was one of his friends in Chicago. But then Nicoletti said, no, it's the president. And for Files, he didn't care at all. I mean, he had no warm feelings for Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs fiasco and so on, where JFK was blamed for the whole fiasco and the death of hundreds of his friends and so on. So he said, no problem at all. But his job was not to be a shooter. His job was to drive a car from Chicago with weapons to Dallas. That was his task. And also check out the terrain in Dallas, check out the roads, everything for the how to escape and so on. So It's important to know also that these operations are always carried out on a very detailed need to know basis. That no one can know the whole picture. Everybody just knows their little tiny part, and so nobody can step forward and reveal what is going on. So this is important to take in account when you listen to people like Chauncey Holt or Tosh Plumlee or James Files and so on, because they only know their little part. The same with Clyde Forshaw and Walt Stabinski. I'm 100% sure none of them had any idea of how many people were involved in this whole thing or who they were. They were just doing their part.
Ole, this is the perfect place to take a second break. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest today. A return engagement, Ole Damegaard. We'll be right back.
Now say, with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority, that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22nd, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
With me and
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing my conversation with Ole Damegaard. Ole, please continue. You were explaining how the compartmentalization means that no one knows the big picture, with the exception of a very few who are controlling it from the top.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why when you listen to people, even who were involved in the shooting itself, they had no idea about how many shooters, how many shots, how nobody knew the whole picture except a very few, elected few. So I think important to take that into account when you put together the jigsaw. Anyway, James Files were given the order to drive this car. It was a 1963 Chevy Impala, burgundy with gun racks in the seats and so on. And he was informed he should drive down to Dallas. He was supposed to only drive in daylight and keep the speed limits, not get any attention at all, just go totally incognito. So he did that, and he came down. He arrived in Dallas, I think, about 5 days before the assassination. He took in, there was a motel called Lamplighter Motel in a little place called Mesquite outside Dallas. And once he arrived there, he called his controller, who was David Attlee Phillips, who was also the controller of Lee Harvey Oswald. And I must say, who was also the controller of another assassin very closely attached to Operation 40 in later years, a man by the name of Michael Vernon Townley, who were at the location when the Swedish Prime Minister, Olof Palme, was shot dead in February 1986. So there are many of the players that was in Dallas was actually also part, or several of them were part of taking out the Swedish Prime Minister many years later. Anyway, so when he arrived to the motel, the Lamplighter Motel, what he did was he followed orders, and he called in. He made two phone calls. He one to Chucky Nicoletti saying, "I'm here on location." And the other one was to David Attlee Phillips just saying, "Same thing, I'm here." So the very next morning, somebody knocked on his door, and he claims that the guy who came and knocked on his door was no one else but Lee Harvey Oswald. So according to Files, the only one that knew that he was there and knew Oswald, since he had seen them together on earlier occasion and so on, must have been David Attlee Phillips. And Oswald told Files that, "Well, I've been instructed to help you. Whatever you need help with, just let me know." So they spent 3-4 days before the assassination, some hours a day, driving around, checking out different areas in Dallas. They did not talk about the assassination. They did not mention it by a word. They were talking about hamburgers, girls, whatever, nothing. And this is also typical with these operations. If you ask questions or if you're too curious, you're dead. So you speak about everything except what's going down. The same after these things happen. I've seen it with agents and killers in South Africa and Argentina and so on. They know, they nod to each other just so that, like, both of them know that it was you who did it last night, whoever they killed and so on. But they never talk about details. They never discuss it. It's never mentioned. It's just gone, you know. Same here. They did not talk about the crime. They did not talk about Kennedy. Nothing like that. They were driving around, checking out streets, you know, finding out where there are dead ends, where there were train crossings, where, you know, anything that could stop a successful escape. And also, Oswald helped him to a place just outside Dallas where he could test fire his rifles and calibrate the scopes and so on. So they spent some time together like that, and James Files really felt he liked Oswald a lot. You know, he speaks highly about him, but he just saw him, you know, as a low-scale CIA operative. According to him, he was a CIA man who had known David Attlee Phillips a lot longer than him, and so on. So he just saw him as one of the guys, and he had absolutely no idea that he was going to take the fall and so on. Anyway, so when we get to the 22nd, in the morning of the 22nd, he was instructed to be at the Cabana Motor Hotel, the hotel that I told you before. And he was supposed to go there and meet Chucky Nicoletti. due to the problems that Nicoletti and the other people from coming from Arizona had, they weren't part of the meeting in the evening, but they came there early in the morning, I think about 5 in the morning or something like that, to the hotel. And when he came there, instead of Nicoletti coming out, Johnny Roselli came out. And I'm going to come back to Johnny Roselli because he flew in together with this Tosh Plumlee, the pilot Tosh Plumlee from Operation 40. I'm going to get back to them. But anyway, so Johnny Roselli jumps into the car and says, we're going to Fort Worth. Okay, so he didn't ask any questions or anything. He drove to Fort Worth. And just when they entered Fort Worth, they took a left and there was this pancake house there. Roselli goes in and he says, are you packing? Are you armed? And File said, always. So he said, okay, just keep an eye on me. And just if anything happens, you need to back me, okay? So Roselli goes in first. File follows him in and positions himself in a different part of the room where he has a clear field of fire. And then a few minutes later, a man that James Files later recognized by the name of Jack Ruby, he did not know him at that time, entered the pancake house, sat down, spoke with Roselli for a few minutes, and then gave him an envelope. Then he left, and after that, Files and Roselli went back to Dallas. On the way back, Roselli opened this envelope, and in it were more of these fake IDs, but also a hand-drawn map over Dealey Plaza. And according to Files, Roselli said, they only made one little change, and that was the change of the route of the motorcade, turning this catastrophe 90 degree into Houston, and then 120 degree left, passing the Texas School Book Depository, which was the key of the whole assassination, to slow down the motorcade so that he would be open for fire from all directions. Anyway, so Files drives back and drops off Roselli. He also noticed another guy at the Cabana Motor Hotel, a man by the name of Hale Braden, also called Eugene Brading, who was a mobster, a low-key mobster from L.A.
And Jim Braden, he's also known as Jim Braden. As you say, multiple aliases.
They had, I don't know how many, 20, 30, 40, like Chauncey Holt. I mean, how many fake IDs had he got? I mean, yes. Countless. Exactly, that's the guy. So Nicoletti came out and they drove into town. They went to Dealey Plaza. And at that time, it seemed, at that point, Files only thought that he would be a driver, a run errand guy and something like that. But then about an hour or so before the assassination, it seems like there was an order coming from this some part of the CIA calling off the operation. And what Nicoletti, when he received that through Roselli or however they got it, Roselli backed out and said, I'm not going to be part of it. Even though he was a former hitman for Al Capone and a good killer, he said, I don't want to do it. I think he was afraid of causing problems, conflicts with the CIA and the mob and everything. So he backed out, and instead Chucky Nicoletti asked Files, would you mind backing me up in this operation? And according to Files, he only thought that there were two shooters, that it was him and Nicoletti, no more. So Files, who admired Chucky Nicoletti, I mean, he said this man walked on water. He cherished him as a person. And he said, I would be most honored to take part of this. Once again, did not care about that it was the president, not at all. He had no feelings when it came to that at all. So what happened was that they parked the car, this burgundy Chevy, behind the Daltex building. He reversed in so that Nicoletti and Roselli and so on could just come out through the back door and into the car. And then files would come from wherever he was shooting, and then get into the car and take off north on Houston Street right after the shooting. That was the plan. So they parked the car there, and the man that helped Nicoletti and Rosselli into the Daltex building was this Hale Braden, or Jim Braden, who somehow had the access. So he let them into a back door. They went up there, and there's some evidence showing that in that building as well, at the time of the assassination, were no one less than George Bush Sr., who was also the paymaster for Operation 40 since the early 1960s. One of the guys that he had on as his right hand when it came to this was a man by the name of Felix Rodriguez, who was later one of the Watergate burglars, who was later super central in the whole Iran-Contra scandal. And very central, he was also the guy who ordered the murder of Che Guevara. And the guy who actually murdered Che Guevara in Bolivia was another man, member of Operation 40, a man by the name of David Morales, or David Morales, who was also present in Dealey Plaza this day. Okay, so they were in the, they got into the Daltex building, and Files positioned himself behind the picket fence. Just like Chauncey Holt, he says also that the whole plaza was packed. It was like a school, I don't know what you call it, like an old boys' home of assassins. I mean, Chauncey Holt and Files, they say that Orlando Bosch was there. Files said that Frank Sturgis was there. He had a green, like a bomber jacket on. He was on the grassy knoll just a few minutes before the shooting, but he said that he left down towards the left, towards the Texas School Book Depository. This is what he says. He saw Freddy Lugo there, another assassin. Luis Posada Carrillas was there. There's one man that was arrested afterwards called Larry Flora. Then when you compare his face with Ted Shackley, one of the top CIA men of the Operation 40, the features are very, very identical, just that he colored it, his hair. So I would say there's a big liability that he could be Ted Shackley there. Also, my God, there were so many. There was also Milwaukee Phil, another mobster from Chicago who was there. And his task was to cover if there was any trouble, to, you know, shoot whoever interfered, and also possibly to take care of Oswald, to be part of one of them who took care of Oswald. Anyway, so Files had positioned himself there, and he says what he did was that he had a jacket on, a silvery color jacket, but what he did was it was one of these that you could turn inside out, and on the inside it had a pattern like a lumberjack type of, I don't know what you call that in English, like square pattern thing.
Plaid.
Yeah, and he had a hat on that he took off. So he was standing there, and he had the weapon that he chose for this assassination was one that he had used a couple of times before. It was a small little gun. It was like a rifle, but with a pistol grip, short barrel rifle, but with a pistol grip. And it was a Remington Fireball XP-100. The caliber 222, and what he had done, this was a super efficient weapon for assassinations, and it was being tested out by the CIA in the early 1960s. It was before it came out on the market for normal people, and there was only one thing that one problem they had, and that was when they had used it for headshots. Sometimes the bullet, ricocheted off the skull. So the way that he wanted to avoid this for whatever assassination he was taking part of was by using a man that helped the mob in Chicago, a very skilled technician. He went under the name of Wolfman. He did all the weapons for the Chicago mob and so on. And what they did was he drilled the top of the bullets with a fine drill, and then filled them with mercury and topped them up with wax. And this made them explode on impact, so that even if you just had an almost miss it would still make an awful wound. Anyway, so he stood like that, and he said that there was one man that from time to time came and checked if everybody was in position. This is, he said different things on different times, because James Files is, to me, it seems like a man of great honor, if you can be that as a mass murderer, but somebody who it's death before disgrace. He does not rat on anyone alive. The only thing, the only people that he's ever talked about or revealed anything about are people that have been killed before him and so on. Anyway, but he has more and more opened up and said more and more things. And in one of these statements, he said that there was one guy that came around and checked that everybody was in position. And this guy was somebody with smaller feet than him. For some reason, he said smaller feet. When you look at Lee Bowers, he said he saw like this young man that fits perfectly with James Files. And there was a guy, an older guy, a bit chubby, white shirt, dark brows, trousers, as far as I remember. And there is a possibility, I would say, that this could be Jack Ruby, even though he always had a suit on. I don't know who this man is. I'm just putting it out there as a possibility. So he pushed in position.
The possibility again being, Ole?
That the older guy could be Jack Ruby.
Okay.
Because it almost seems like E. Howard Hunt was taking care of one team, and that Ruby was taking care of the team from the on the grassy knoll part, checking that everything was there, and then staying in contact with the communication center, which once again I think was in the Adolphus Hotel. In a suite there. Anyway, so when the motorcade came around the corner, up until that point, he had had the gun down by the side. He had been standing smoking very openly, and it had been raining that morning, so it was muddy and so on. But these people were informed before that they would not be charged. It would be they would be safe. So they were very careless, like they left Coca-Cola bottles on the wall or cigarette butts, or not like if anybody in a normal crime that really would fear of being caught, sort of. And he was doing the same thing. He was smoking, just dropping cigarette butts around him and so on. And he was also looking through the scope over the fence, just checking out if there were people in the crowd wearing weapons so that he could identify them if there was anyone he needed to fear once he's tried to leave the crime scene and so on. And that's why when he saw all of these characters, like I mentioned, and lots more of them that he recognized from the Bay of Pigs invasion and so on. Anyway, so the car comes around, and when it turns into Elm Street, he gets the gun up on top of the picket fence, and he had been instructed by Nicoletti that do not fire unless it's absolutely necessary. And he said the only thing we're going for is a headshot. That is what he claims that Nicoletti told him. So he sees the car come down Elm Street, and the shooting starts. But he doesn't count like one, two, three, four shots. What he counted was miss, 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 and so on. And then when the car came almost to a standstill right in front of him down under the grassy knoll, I mean, it's a shot of like 8-9 meters. It's a turkey shoot. It's super simple. And he had him totally zoomed in, and he waited, but then there was no headshot fired. So in the end, he just said, that's it. And he pulled one shot off. He said he aimed right at JFK's right eye. But just like he saw in the scope that just like a half a second or a microsecond before the shot was fired, JFK's head was thrown forward. So that he said that instead of hitting him in the eye, the shot entered right in the right temple, a little above the eye, and then blew the whole back of his head off. And so once that, as soon as he saw that the shot was fired, he went down behind the picket fence, and he put the gun back in the gun case, a small little like a briefcase type of looking thing. Turned the jacket inside out so that it was silver colored. Put on a hat, and then walked without looking anywhere else. Walked along the picket fence, and then on the back side of the school book depository, heading for the Deltex parking. But before that, he did something that afterwards he said if Nicoletti had known that, he would have killed him. What he did was, he claims that he took the shell case, the cartridge, yeah, and bit down on it. He had this love for the taste of sulfur. And he just bit down on it, and then he put it on top of the fence before he walked off. And when asked about it, he says that it was so stupid, but he felt totally, that nothing could hurt him, that he was
invincible.
Invincible.
Yeah.
Exactly. Anyway, this shell case was later found many years later by a gardener. And there is a very specific dent, like if somebody has been biting on it, and some dentists have confirmed that it was bitten on by teeth. The FBI has the teeth records of James Files. At this nowadays, he's got false teeth, but they've got the original ones, but they've refused to share them so that it could be proven if it's true what he says or not. But anyway, he went back, got into the Chevy. By that time, Chucky Nicoletti was sitting in the front seat, Roselli in the back. He put his gun behind the seat and they took off without saying anything. Went north on Houston Street. They went 4 or 5 blocks, then took a lift. And there was a gas station there, I think on the other side of the Freeman's Highway. Stemmons Anyway, there was a gas station there where he stopped, and Nicoletti and Roselli left the car. That was the last thing he saw of them. But before that, Nicoletti had said, that's the only time he criticized Files, and he said, don't you think you were a bit over, that he was overdoing it, which Files were. He was kind of irritated to hear a thing like that, but that was the only thing that was ever mentioned about the assassination. That was the only thing ever. Anyway, so
what did he mean by overdoing it?
That I think if you look at it, his shot from the right, blowing off the skull of Kennedy, that is the one that messed the whole thing up, because otherwise they would have been able to get away with a one shooter, blaming it on Oswald. Because they would be able to get the other wounds and so on fitted in so that it could be blamed on one guy. But this shot coming from a totally different direction messed the whole thing up. Anyway, so according to Files, he went back to the motel, and what he did was he waxed his whole... He took a shower and he waxed his whole body, pulled it off to get off any type of traces of nitrate from gunpowder and so on, and even his face, to get rid of that. And while he was in there, another knock on the door. At that time, I mean, he was quite jumpy because he had just been part of a hit, and the last thing he wanted to was that he would be revealed. And he looked outside, and outside was a man that he knew. He was best man at his wedding, a man by the name of Gary Marlowe, who he had absolutely no idea that he was in Dallas that day, and so on. But this Gary Marlowe came and said, listen, I just had to smoke a cup. Can you please take the gun? Please take it. And it was a revolver. And Files was like, oh, get out of here, you know, absolutely no way. Whatever, just sort of. So he closed and locked the door after him. He has no idea where this guy went afterwards and so on. But according to Files, he believes that Gary Marlowe was one of the shooters of J.D. Tippit.
Ole, let's take a break here. This is our final break. Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal with my special guest, Ole Domegaard. We'll be right back.
There are places I remember.
Stem cell research, abortion, cloning, evolution, creation science, intelligent design. These are hot button issues today. Religion and science, morality and government, corporations and fascism. If you want to know what's happening to this nation this very day, then you won't want to miss Render Unto Darwin. After 35 years of teaching logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning, Jim Fetzer offers a critique of the Christian Rights Crusade against science. If you want to understand the issues, if you want to be informed, this is a book you won't want to miss. Render Unto Darwin, at Amazon.com and the major bookstores. Render Unto Darwin.
Listener supported. We need your donations to pay for live internet streaming radio, our toll-free call-in number, and our website, free MP3 archive links, and interactive forums. RevereRadioNetwork.com and click on the Make a Donation
from all the love. people, where do they all belong? Father Mackenzie, writing the words of a sermon that no one will hear. No one comes near, look at him working, darning his socks in the night when there's nobody there. What does he care for all the lonely people? Where do they all come from? All the lonely people, where do they all belong?
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, concluding my conversation with Ole Damgaard. Ole, you've about your observations regarding James Files, just a couple of thoughts on my part and why I've been skeptical about Files. When the Confession of an Assassin was first released, I was asked by a local radio television station in Duluth to review it for them, and I watched it twice and told them that I had certain doubts about it, for the reason that in that interview he did not mention how the limousine had been brought to a halt, which set up his shot, and which seemed to me, you know, most important for understanding his role in the assassination, not to mention that he had claimed he was introduced into the assassination as a shooter that very morning, which seemed to me to be far-fetched in the extreme. I do find the Remington Fireball a fascinating alternative possibility as one of the weapons used here. The actual shot did enter in the vicinity of the right temple and created the shock waves. It was a frangible or exploding bullet that created shock waves. It blew about half his brains out the back of his already weakened cranium and created a fist-sized hole in the back of his head just to the right of center. So if you took your fist and doubled it up and put it back just to the right of center, you'll see the dimensions of the hole and where the brains were blown to the left rear with so much force that when they struck Officer Bobby Hargis riding there, he initially thought he himself had been shot. Now, David believes, and I'm inclined to agree, that the fatal shot actually was taken when the limousine was further down Elm Street than the officially designated location reflects, and that it was more or less opposite the steps leading up to the pergola, where the alternative shooter for this shot would appear to be Frank Sturgis, who actually admitted to New York City Gold Shield Detective Jim Rothstein when he arrested him in New York City when he came there to attempt to murder Marita Lorenz to make sure that she would not testify to the HSCA, that he had fired the shot that killed JFK, and he'd done it because he betrayed them at the Bay of Pigs and because he was cavorting with beautiful women who were spies for foreign governments. So, you know, this is my conundrum. I mean, you know, I completely respect your work, and I'm just really explaining the difference in our views about James Files and who fired that particular shot.
For sure, for sure. It is a an enigma inside a labyrinth, inside of a safety box, inside of, it's like not easy. But I think the more we talk about it and the more we go into details, then there's a possibility of new angles appearing. So I would like to go on to the Texas School Book Depository.
Yes, please do continue.
I know also that we don't really agree on what's happened there, but according to what I've been able to find out, I believe that there were three people on the sixth floor, the so-called sniper's nest, and also, for just so your listeners know, it's one big room the whole sixth floor, so people could move easily from different windows and so on. And there was a black man up there. There was two white people, one of them with very heavy rimmed glasses, where there's people thinking that this is this man was Mark Wallace, Lyndon B. Johnson's henchman. And I would tend to disagree. I totally believe that he was there. He was part of building the sniper's nest, that is for sure. But when you look at his resume, he was not very good with arms. And when there were arms involved in the assassination that he did, the murders that he did, they were very clumsy, loads of shots fired and not very clean and so on. Instead, I would say that according to Sam Giancana, the mobster's nephew and brother, they identified this man as Sam Giancana.
In the book Double Cross, which they co-authored, Madeline Duncan Brown, Lyndon's mistress, with whom she began an affair in 1948 and by whom she bore a son, Stephen, in 1950, told me, however, and she was an avid shooter herself, that the 2 weeks before the assassination, she was out at the Skeeton Gun Club and that Mac Wallace was there and that he never missed, that he was a phenomenal shot. So there's a discrepancy here in whether or not Mac Wallace was or was not a good shot. I agree that murders like that of Henry Wallace, agriculture, Department of Agriculture inspector, was shot 5 times with a single-shot bolt-action rifle, had carbon monoxide over his head and been hit over the head to render him unconscious. A murder done by Mac Wallace was not a very clean piece of work. So it's a very interesting conundrum sorting out about the role of Mac Wallace.
It's also, there's a big difference between shooting at targets and shooting at somebody to kill, you know, depending on how well you are with your nerves and so on. I would say, thank you for correcting me with the shooting. I did not know about what Madeleine had told you. But anyway, I would suggest that this man on the sixth floor would be Richard Kane. He was a former policeman from Chicago. He was he knew J.D. Tippit, he knew Roscoe White, which both were closely involved in this whole drama as well. And afterwards, like some sources claim that Sam Giancana and Richard Kane were booked at the Adolphus Hotel, which is just a few hundred meters down on Commerce Street. Now, on the other side of Dealey Plaza, after the shots were fired, there was a witness who saw that there were 4 people coming out on behind the Texas School Book Depository. They went into what appeared to be a Nash Rambler that was parked on the wrong side of the street, right on the corner of the School Book Depository, on the Houston Street, but just by the corner there. And at that time, if you look at other photos, there's one photo where there's a black man, or very dark-skinned man, who resembles David Morales, I think, very, very much. He's up on a lamppost looking over the whole thing, trying to see what's going on while the shots are being fired. And that is exactly where this car was parked, according to this other witness. What he said was that 3 of the people went into the Rambler, and it took off going north on Houston Street, just where Files and they also went the same way. But the 4th person who had, and he said that it was the same person that he saw on the 6th floor of the School Book Depository. He saw him run down Houston Street and then turn left down on Commerce Street running. And that is exactly the direction for the Adolphus Hotel where Richard Kane was staying, had a room with Sam Giancana. So I think that it's very, very possible that that person was Richard Kane, according to myself. Also, if you see after the assassination, his career went straight up there. He became Giancana's right hand, and they went internationally to many, many different countries. And but in the end, he became big-headed and was assassinated, as so many of these other people involved. There's one thing that I also would like to mention that is, as a possible theory, why Lee Harvey Oswald was found on the second floor of the school book depository. I believe that if you notice that just before the assassination, what happened was that the electricity was turned off in the school book depository. Phone lines were cut off, just like also the motorbike, one of the motorbike policemen blocked the police radio. And this is also standard on these major assassinations, that they cut communication, they cut any form of people being able to get the real story out there before they can control it. So they just shut everything down. And this is exactly what happened in the school book depository. Everything was turned off. So the elevator didn't work. And the phone lines, that's also why two of the employees, two women, they had to take the stairs down from the thing. But if you look at exactly where Oswald was observed when the police and the manager of the school book depository ran in, he's standing drinking a Coke, but he's standing right by the elevator shaft. And if you remember that these people have been trained, Richard Kane was also part of training and being part of this for the Bay of Pigs invasion, in training guerrilla warfare, all types of jungle warfare and these things, including, what is that called? Jumping down with a rope, lowering yourself with ropes.
Yeah.
With ropes and so on.
Rappelling.
And I would suggest that there's a possibility that Oswald's task was, for one thing, to stand and wait for a phone call from David Attlee Phillips to instruct him for the next thing, because I think he was there to try and stop the whole assassination, but also to be sure to control the elevator so that nobody would go up to the sixth book floor and interfere with what was going on there. Then by standing there, he could, if people came down on a rope, what was that called? Like jump down inside the elevator shaft. He could open and let them out, because there were four different exits on the back of the school book depository. That would be the way out for these people. And I think that the driver was David Morales, and he was later the guy that a few minutes later came back in the same Nash Rambler and picked up someone, either Oswald or Clyde Forshaw. I'm not sure who was that. But I think that could be the task of Oswald. Also, if you, in Grodin's book, with all the pictures, it says that the person in the entrance that has been claimed to be Lovelady, I know that you've had programs where you've gone into great details, and I'm not sure who have you identified as being. Is it Oswald or is it Billy Lovelady in the entrance of the school book depository?
Oh, it was Lee Oswald. I personally have no doubt. There's a huge amount of research
exactly.
on it, and
I've
published a dozen articles on it.
Yeah, I just wanted to check with you, because I totally believe that as well. But it said in Grodin's book that person went in and then helped the police to get in the elevator and get it up there. So he was handling the elevator at that point as well, just a few minutes later. So I would just put forward that suggestion that is a possibility. Also, when it comes to Clyde Forshaw, and what he says was that he was standing to the right of Zapruder firing. I would also say that people like him are bragging, just like Sturgis and Charles Harrison, Clyde, and so on, that they were the ones doing the final shot. But I would say that there was only one shot fired, so somebody has to lie, or somebody has to brag, or whatever. Maybe they even missed there was a shot fired. But when you look at when it's the whole motorcade is filmed from the other side of the grass, Orville Nix, when you look at the original film up against where the wall is, there's a white wall, it looks exactly like there's a station wagon reversed in, a white one, and next to it you have a shooter with almost like his elbow up on the roof of the car, and he's following. It's very obvious once you see it, especially on the earlier versions of Orville Nix's film, before it was edited too much. So I would suggest that there's this guy by the car who could well be Clyde, and next to him is who's called the Batchman, which I think these are not the same guys at all. They're standing next to each other, almost like a firing team. So I would say you got the, you got possibly Clyde, or that could be Frank Sturgis as well, the car, and then a few meters to the side of it, you got a railroad worker and then a man in uniform, Dallas police uniform, called Batchman.
Are you you talking about a photograph in the killing of a president?
Yeah, there's several photographs showing
which
this.
Which ones did you want? Did you specify the page, Oli? Did that slip by me?
I'm sorry, I do not have the book here.
Okay,
but,
okay.
But the Orwell Nix film, there's one early English documentary about the JFK assassination where they put up a lot of different questions that has not been answered. And in that film, they make a very clear, they have a very clear copy of the man by the car, and they even enlarged it very much so that you can clearly see that there's a dark-haired white guy with a rifle in a white shirt, light trousers as well, that is aiming at the limousine. If he's shooting or not, I do not know, but he's aiming.
Some of the photographs relevant to what you're talking about are on pages 50 through 57. You know, taken immediately after the shooting. Others you're talking about were taken, of course, during or before. Yes. Please continue.
And then I think that this car was reversed in by Roland Otis, Haley's brother, if the shooter is Clyde, as she claims. And if you see it, Orville Nix, the camera goes past the wall, and then the next photos that are taken, when the final headshots are fired, the car is already on its way out. So it feels like, you know, even though the shooting is still on, the car is taking off. And there's this big enlargement of the photo where you can see a guy turning around. It's this open, there are two pages in the book with a big enlargement where up on the right-hand side, there's one photo showing one guy.
Yeah, this is page 57 you're talking about.
Thank you. And he's dressed, he's dark-haired and dressed in light clothes, both trousers and shirt, exactly like the guy that was a shooter a few seconds before. And then I would suggest that you got the so-called Batchman and next to him a railroad worker who would be the spotter alternative, the breakdown guy. The breakdown guy is sometimes when they do these assassinations, they have one spotter who takes care of the radio traffic, the whole communication. His task is also to check escape routes and that there's no interference so that the shooter can be totally focused on his part, which is only to hit. That's the only thing he should focus on. And then sometimes you got a breakdown guy as well who as soon as the shots are fired, will be thrown the weapon, and his job is to dismantle it into pieces and get rid of it out of the way, away from the shooter so that they go in different directions. There is a possibility that the man who did the shooting in the Dallas police uniform was a man called by the name of Lucien Sarti, a very, very high-skilled assassin as well, that was imported for this job from the Marseille mob by, I think it was through Carlos, no, Santos Traficante, and he was taken to, together with some other accomplices, to Mexico City, which is crucial when it comes to this operation, and also the disposal of several of the people involved in this. They're all killed in Mexico City later on. If that is by coincidence or I don't know, but they are. Lucien Sarti was a very bold guy, almost careless, but at the same time extremely successful as a killer because he was so fearless. And I would suggest, once again, this is a theory, but there was a witness called Ed Hoffman, a deaf mute, that was way up on Stemmer's Freeway. He was sitting with a clear view down over the parking lot behind the picket fence, who saw that he saw it was like a puff of smoke. And he said that he saw a guy I think he had black trousers and a blue shirt or something like that, with a rifle. And there was a railroad worker that he walked towards, threw the rifle to him, turned around, put on a hat, and then slowly walked along the picket fence, while the railroad worker took the gun and went behind like a little electrical cupboard. I don't know what you call these type of things. Dismantled the rifle, put it into a toolbox, and then slowly started walking towards the railroad tracks where these box cars where Chauncey Holt and Charles Harrelson and Carlos Montoya, Richard Montoya, was hiding in. So I think that Ed Hoffman, it's important once again, when somebody is a witness, it's very rarely that their observation is 100% accurate. It very often they mix details together, even though they really try to give a truthful statement. I would suggest that it's possible that he's mixing together James Files as the guy who put on the hat, which is exactly what James Files said he did, and then slowly walked along this picket fence, which is exactly what Files says. There's also a photo of the silhouette of a person who does exactly like Files says at that time, walks towards the school book depository behind the whole thing. Yes. But I think that the thing that he mixes, I believe that possibly the man, the shooter in the Delta, in the Dallas police uniform, is the one passes James Files, throws the gun to the railroad worker, then turns around and start meeting people running up the grassy knoll, while Files is the one walking away. Because this day as well, there was so many cars in this parking lot. There was when people came from the Triple Underpass running, trying to get in there and see if they could get the killer, they had to roll across cars and jump. It was very tight. So also Ed Hoffman was, it was quite a long distance. So it's just a suggestion that would make these two things fit together.
Ollie, that's fascinating. This whole thing has been fascinating. Those who want to appreciate the differences in our views, of course, if they aren't already familiar, can review my video study, JFK at 50, the who, the how, and the why. I'm looking forward to having you back. Is there anything you'd like to add now in the few moments we have that remain?
I would like to say my website is lightonconspiracies.com, and like, if you know, if anyone, that this type of research is very, very hard to do without finances, and I'm struggling, and I would so appreciate financial support of any kind. Also, I'm very much looking forward to make a top quality documentary once I get in touch with the right people about Operation 40 and how this group of assassins are connecting so many of these different terror acts and killings on a high level and so on. And I would just also finish with the thing that the reason why this assassination is so important, it is a murder in the early 1960s, but the reason why it's crucial to find out what happened that day is because the people that killed him, the people that slaughtered him, are still in power. These are the ones that have led the states and the world into so many of these awful wars, and they have this agenda of death and destruction that are affecting millions of people. And so by opening up this wound from 50 years ago, it will be a way to track down what actually happened, what is going on today, and will help us heal this whole place.
Ollie, I could not agree with you more. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking my very special guest today, Ollie Domegard, for being here, and all of you for listening.
Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday came suddenly. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Yesterday, love was such an easy game to play. I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Yesterday, love was such an easy game to play. Now I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday.